The following is a recording of a discussion group at Ordinary Mind Zendo. The texts we take up for study in these groups range from koan collections to poetry to psychoanalytic papers. If you enjoy listening, please consider donating. Ordinary Mind Zendo is a nonprofit organization that depends on the generosity of people like you.
In any case, these are talks given in 1952, and you can think of them as part of an ongoing question being asked at that time of what went wrong with the 20th century. And the dilemma facing people then was that the things that they had seemed to put their greatest faith in, technology, democracy, progress, or alternatively, the various socialist, Marxist, utopian ideas, all one way or another, had come to very, very bad ends, or had many unintended consequences. Utopian socialism had ended up with Stalin. The progressive science had just given us Hiroshima. Nothing had been capable of preventing the rise of nationalism and fascism. So, in a sense, Berlin is talking at a time when everyone is sort of questioning what were the core assumptions that we have been operating by, what is their history, and how did things go wrong. And Berlin is a great defender of liberty and looks back at the origins of our contemporary notions of liberty in the Enlightenment and asks and wants to look at different representative thinkers and look at the ways their ideas contained within them some of the problems that later emerged, so that when we talk about freedom and its betrayal, it's not as if there are these pure promulgators of freedom who are betrayed by some kind of Judas who oppose those ideas. It's much more that the different pictures of freedom itself contained within them their own contradictions. And this was an idea that was being, in some ways, simultaneously worked through by Adorno and Horkheimer in the Frankfurt School. You know, they write the Dialectic of the Enlightenment as another kind of critique of how Enlightenment thinking, which starts with rational, you know, a great belief in the rational and progress, devolves into scientism and instrumental thinking, and how this again turns on itself. But Berlin is going to go back to some people that we think of relatively obscure now, or who we don't read directly, but they each in their own way represent a way of thinking that underlies our different conceptions of the good life. He says that the primary political question of the day was why should people obey anyone, right? What is the foundation or grounds for government and political hierarchy? I think that we might look at some of these people also in terms of the question of the older philosophical questions of how should we live and what does it mean to organize an ideal society. It's, you see, I mean, what we have here is the heady days leading up to the French Revolution, mm-hmm. and this first great overthrow of monarchy and a replacement by some grand experiment, right? So, in a sense, in the 18th century, people are really first questioning the whole religious political framework which had been taken for granted for centuries. One way or another, the religious authority of the church and the authority of the kings had been conflated into the idea of the divine right of kings, that there was a natural order to the universe that included not just a physical and biological order, but a social and political order, and that the hierarchy of people and classes was presumed in some sense to be God-given. Right? Now, the English had their first experiment at overthrowing this in the 17th century, and they did this remarkable thing of cutting off the head of King Charles. And they, under Cromwell, had an experiment in revolutionary democracy. But the great landowners and bourgeoisie got cold feet, and they opted for a increased powers of parliament, but got themselves a new king very quickly. Decided they did not like the taste of freedom they had given themselves. It was just too much was up for grabs all at once. And so they adopted a parliamentary democracy where they had a king but with some sense of checks from below. But the French, they didn't do anything halfway. And when they cut off their king's head, they had a serious revolution and wanted to start from scratch in creating an ideal society. Now, in many people's opinion, that also went horribly wrong. And it what starts out as the pursuit of freedom ends in the terror, and order is only restored with the dictatorship of Napoleon. Right?
There's a lot of like tidy assumptions in there, though. I kind of feel like when like a people are so downtrodden that there's a lot of anger that needs to be released. I mean, you know, doesn't that say more about like you know how they were treated than anything about like certain models of politics?
Well, how they were treated under a certain system of government, under a certain power structure. Everybody clearly was poor and pissed off who was at the bottom of this power structure, and they wanted it changed. And they, but they, their ideas of how it should change and what they should be put into mm-hmm. its place mm-hmm. were all over the map. Mm-hmm. And these different thinkers are sort of versions of the map of the territory of what should we put in its place, or what their ideas of what was wrong and what should we do differently, right? Now,
how does the American Revolution fit into all of this? Because so far it hasn't gone horribly awry. I mean, it seemed to have been unique at that time.
It depends who you are.
Yeah.
Oh. It didn't work out so well
for everybody, but yes, as experiments go, it worked better than the French.
Right.
Well, it had a stronger foundation. It was distant from the central power. It already had 13 functions.
Being far away helped, but that will take us a little far afield here. What I want to say about, as an introduction to this essay, is that Berlin sets up two canonical figures as bookends to all these people. On the one hand, it's Newton, and on the other, it's Marx. In a certain sense, he's looking at how one led to the other. He's looking at how a certain scientific, secularized worldview that led to a notion of determinism was carried over into the social sciences and led to the kind of expectation that what Newton did for physics, somebody should be able to do for politics and economics and history. And in a certain sense, Marx became the ultimate person who was put forward as the Newton of economics.
For
right?
a while.
For a long while.
For a long while.
For a long while. But these thinkers, in one way or another, all adopted the fantasy of a Newton for politics, right? And so what I'd like to read first here is a section from the introduction. It's on page 6 of this book. I don't know.
It's the first sentence?
But all these men were overtopped by Newton, whose eminence was unique in the annals of mankind. Do you find that place? Gail, do you want to read from there?
Among all the men of his age, the radiation of his name and achievement really was the greatest. He was praised by the poets, he was praised by the prose writers. He was regarded almost as a semi-divine being. Was so regarded because people thought that at last the whole of physical nature had been adequately and completely explained. This is because Newton had triumphantly managed to express in very few, very simple, and very easily communicable formulae laws from which every movement and every position of every particle of matter in the universe could in principle be deduced. Everything which had previously been explained by other means, sometimes theologically, sometimes in terms of obscure metaphysics, at last seemed bathed in the light of the new science. Everything was interconnected, everything was harmonious, everything could be deduced from everything else. The laws in terms of which this could be done were, again, very few and easily acquired by anyone who chose to take the trouble to learn them. One needed for this no special faculty, no theological insight, no metaphysical gifts, merely the power of clear reasoning and of impartial observation, and of verifying observations by means of specially arranged experiment wherever this was possible.
Yeah, keep going for a little bit.
In the sphere of politics, in the sphere of morals, no such coordinating principle, no such authority could apparently be found. If it was asked why I should obey the ruler or of the state, why anyone should ever obey anyone else, the answers were altogether too many and too various. Because, as some said, this was the word of God. vouchsafed in a sacred text of supernatural origin, or perhaps by direct revelation to men whose authority in these matters is recognized through the medium of the church, or perhaps given by direct revelation to the individual himself, or because God had himself ordained the great pyramid of the world. That is what someone like Filmer said in the 17th century, for example, of the great French Bishop Bossuet. The king must be obeyed because this is the order of the world, commanded by God and perceived by both reason and faith, and the commands of God are absolute, and to ask for the other, for the source of their authority is itself impious. Because, said others, the command to obey the ruler is issued by the ruler or his agents. The law is what the ruler wills, and because he wills it, whatever his motive, it may not be examined at all. That is the theory of absolute monarchy.
Okay.
Who's Filmer?
No one we've ever read. He's the kind of name that he drops in here, and we don't need to chase that particular reference down.
The great French bishop.
Right.
Maybe it's beside the point, probably, but you know, Newton was not this secular figure that he was, you know, thought of. Like, he was profound. He spent most of his time studying the Bible and chronology, and he thought that the natural order of the universe, the way things worked, was, you know, worked because God was present and moving things along in every moment, in every place. But that wasn't known, you know, or really.
Yes, I think his biography is, as you say, much more complicated than we imagine. But again, the dilemma is that his discoveries in one realm became the basis of a metaphor for how to think about things in another realm. And that is, that becomes the great influence or achievement. Berlin elsewhere talks about there are basically three kinds of problems in the world. You can arrange them in three heaps, he says. The first kinds of problems are mathematical or logical problems, and they, or like a problem in chess. The problems are solvable entirely in terms of what's internal to the definition of the terms. If you know algebra or mathematics or the rules of chess or logic, if a problem is posed in one of those things, you figure it out in terms of what are the axioms of that system. You don't need anything from the outside to solve the problem. The second kind of problem are empirical problems, where you solve them by going out and discovering some bit of new information that you didn't have before. If you want to try to figure out how the heart works or how blood is pumped, you have to do experiments and examine a body and do understand the physiology of things. And it's not something that can simply be deduced from an armchair. You have to actually poke around inside the body and see how the damn thing works, right? So it's an empirical kind of science. You have to learn about it. And the third kind of problem are the ones he calls philosophical problems, where the problems are problems by virtue of the concepts that we use to organize our experience. And so that when we examine something philosophically, we're not looking for new information, and we're not simply rearranging the pieces on the chessboard. We're asking, what are the concepts or metaphors we're using to frame the problem in the first place, right? So with Newton, what happens is we get this powerful metaphor taken from physics that says everything has a determinable cause and predictable effect given your understanding of the underlying laws of nature, right? And this became the basis of a kind of background, unquestioned, metaphorical way of thinking about things. So that for a while, it became the assumption that naturally what we're trying to do is extend that into as many spheres as possible. That Newton's way of looking at things is absolutely true, and that everything else that happens in some way has to be compatible with that, and we want to get our so-called soft sciences of things like psychology and history in line with the hard sciences, because they are demonstrably foundational, right?
I don't know if Facebook is indicative of anything, but his name crops up a lot now, particularly in British posts, about how he's a good example of how to lead us out of the current chaos.
You
go on and on about pretty much what you've just said.
In our own time, we got in the grip of the metaphor of the computer model of the mind. And so that that metaphor was so compelling that people just assumed that the mind must be a representational and computational machine that we could in some way or another replicate, right? And it was assumed that this was simply a matter of brute technology, right? Of finally figuring out how to generate enough computations in a computer that would replicate what the brain was doing, because the brain must itself be a computer. It's only with great difficulty that we tear ourselves away from the idea that what the brain is doing is computing, right? It was for so long considered a settled matter of fact that it wasn't even called into question that maybe you're making the wrong analogy here.
Right? We didn't arrive there by philosophy, though. It was new data that conflicted with the old data, with the model.
No, actually what happened is finally some people got some data that made them pay attention to what certain philosophers have been saying for a long time. You can look at what Dreyfus was writing in the 60s about why AI wasn't going to work. People brought in all sorts of philosophical objections that the cognitive science people refused to look at because they were positive they had the answer and this was a computer, period. It was but I don't want to argue it so much as the idea that we get in the grip of a metaphor, right? And so Berlin wants to say that Newton is the purveyor of the great metaphor of physics, that these different thinkers in one way or another are going to try to extend to science, of the science into history and politics. And it's the idea in a way is now to give a whole new foundation to the political order. What we call the Enlightenment is the sweeping away of the theological underpinnings of society, and the sweeping away of a of monarchy as a unexamined given in the realm of politics. And this happens because people are beginning to think that we can use reason and science to understand the order of the universe and of society in a way that doesn't rely on the Bible or mere history to say how things are supposed to be. And so this was an enormously liberating idea, right? It gets you out from under the thumb of the church and out from under the thumb of the king and says you have the right to think for yourselves and try to devise how should society be organized, right? For the first time anybody is sort of doing this, or the first time in a very long time, since Greece anyway. So the first one up to bat in this this lineup.
Doesn't that also sweep away like plurality, like what you just described? Like it's sort of like this one size fits all.
Well, Newton sweeps away plurality or pluralism. Berlin is the great champion of pluralism. What he is saying is one of the great faults of these thinkers is what he calls monism, a one-size-fits-all way of life for everybody. And so that one of the unexamined assumptions here is that there is such a thing as one good society for everybody, everywhere, in all times, in all places, right? When we think about physics, we don't think about, well, this is a pretty good physics for the 20th century, but we don't, obviously they didn't need this physics in the 19th century, or you don't need it in China. It's just European. Physics was ahistorical, timeless, and universal, right? The fantasy was that there was going to be some social equivalent of this that would be timeless. Now, this might seem like a completely crazy idea that there would be a timeless right way to live, and you'd probably have to be as crazy as somebody like Dogen to believe that, right? You see, well, we are part of a tradition that really, you know, has a book that says there really is a timeless right way to live that is the expression of Buddha nature, right? He doesn't just say Zazen is the expression of enlightenment. He says this whole monastic form of life is that, right?
It's like our Bible.
It's like our Deuteronomy with all the rules of daily conduct, right? And I think we have to use something like what we read in the Berlin to realize the extent to which a religious practice contains with it in these assumptions that purport to be timeless, purport to be completely acultural, right? That when you look at the koans, in the Mumon Khan, Mumon in his commentary says, when you penetrate Mu, you will see through the eyes of the patriarchs. Your eyebrows will be entangled with theirs, and your vision will be identical to theirs, right? And that there's a whole sense that that lineage means that my realization is the realization of Rinzai. It is the realization of Shakyamuni.
Well, the metaphor that is in the grip there is that it's a pinch, and it's the pinch that's transmitted from one person to the next.
That's right. That there's some way in which it's almost at the level of physical sensation, you know, that's sort of or shining a light, and that somehow this is going to be true for all people, no matter where they are in any kind of circumstance.
But that's just another metaphor, you're saying.
But this is just a metaphor, and it's when we think about it, there is nothing else that we would ascribe that to in any other cultural realm. It's really analogous to physics. It's really mm-hmm. like saying the law of thermodynamics or inertia is the same now as for Buddha, right? And in fact, a lot of Buddhism is that kind of natural theology where it wants to ground a kind of religious insight into the way the world is, right? That we have an understanding of how the whole world as a whole works, right? Based on ideas of impermanence and interdependence, and that is true in all places for all time, and that there is therefore a certain kind of psychological reality and insight that is going to be true in all places and at all times, right? I mean, that's really the underlying assumption. And I think that a big part of what happens in Western Buddhism is sort of seeing that assumption is just that, it's assumption, and that we can't find any way to really justify that in any other way than we think about that.
It seems to me that all of this reflects a desperation for the answer, for explanation. And I think, I don't know, maybe it's because of our psyche, we can't deal with the fact that there is no answer. There is no ultimate explanation. There is no metaphor that works.
For everything, yes. I think Berlin wants to come to around eventually to an idea that there are lots of explanations. As opposed to none or one,
right?
But some of these are incompatible with each other, and there's no place to stand to pick between them. But the picture he presents here with Newton is that we've left an age of religious certainty, and we immediately replaced it with scientific certainty. That we could not do without certainty, as you say, right? And so that it's the beginning of scientism, where science is going to provide the order and certainty that religion provided. Right, that we're not going to have revelation anymore. We're going to have Newton.
Well, it's the idea that science is free of faith. That, like, you know, they're immune to that kind of like pure belief.
Yes. Well, there are two kinds of issues there. One is whether science itself has some things in it that we have to take on faith. The second issue is sort of sociological, that says science has moved into the niche vacated by religion, right? Where it now becomes the foundational metaphor and explanatory system. Everything has to get referred back to that, the way everything else used to get referred back to the Bible, right?
It occupies
the place of religion, and it the great danger here is that of certainty. Mm. You know, the absolutism of your answer, which in some sense replicates religious fundamentalism. Now, let's read a little bit on the first one, Helvetius or Helveti. I was trying to find the correct pronunciation. He is a Frenchman, and I think with a Latinized name, and I am not going to try to tell you who, how to say it, but I...
Well, it says here Helvetius is the Latin version of Schweitzer.
Yes, it's a Latin version, but because he was living in France, it seems like they may have pronounced it Helvetii, something like that. But after today, you'll probably never hear it pronounced again, so it's sort of a moot point. Helvetii is trying to do for politics what Newton did, and here you can see on page 12 it says his lifelong aim was the search for a single principle which was to define the basis of morality and really answer the questions of how society should be founded and how man should live, where he should go, and what he should do, with the same degree of scientific authority Newton had displayed in the realm of physics. Right? I mean, that's really the crux of the problem and the solution all rolled into one, right? And Helvetii thought he had found it, and therefore supposed himself to be the founder of a great new science, that he could put in order at long last this vast moral and political chaos. He thought himself, in short, to be the Newton of politics. Yeah. As mathematics and physics perfect the arts of supplying our simple needs, is it not part of the same order of nature that progress in the moral and political science should exercise the same effect on the motives which rule our actions and feelings? All right. So, he... he thinks he has found the equivalent answer, and he explains it in a little parable here, one paragraph long, and he says, he imagines a dialogue between God and man, which is sort of ironic because he doesn't believe in God, but what he's doing is setting up this little parable of the origin of things, right? And putting it in the old language of man and God, right? So, he makes God say to man, I endow thee with sensibility. It is by this alone that thou, blind tool of my wishes, incapable of plumbing my aims, thou must, without knowing it, fulfill my purposes. Over thee I set pleasure and pain. The one and the other will watch over thy thoughts and acts, excite thy aversions, friendships, tender sentiments, joys, set on fire thy desires, fears, hopes, reveal to thee truths, plunge thee in error, and after causing thee to generate a million various absurd systems of morals and legislation, will one day disclose to thee the simple principles on the development of which depend the order and happiness of the moral world. And Berlin comments, what is this but the first clear formulation of the principle of utilitarianism? Right? According to this principle, the only thing which men wish is pleasure, and the only thing which men wish to avoid are pains. The pursuit of pleasure and the avoidance of pain are the only motives which are in fact operating on men, as gravitation and other physical principles are said to act on inanimate bodies. At last we have discovered the central principle. So, in another sense, what you have here is now a radical humanism being proposed, that the linchpin or the spring of society is going to be found in human psychology. It's not found in any order of the universe, right? It's
not like Pavlov to me.
Yes, he's got Pavlov. Mm-hmm. Pavlov has this kind of basic utilitarian idea in which you can use pain and pleasure for conditioning, except. You know, here we've got folks who want to do it on a grand scale. We're not just working with dogs, right? But I think that what is both positive and negative about this is the sort of the radical psychologizing of morality, right? It used to be that what was moral was something that was divinely given and was intended to shape and organize human life according to a higher notion of the good, right? I mean, most of the time when from people from Plato to the on, when they talk about morality, talk about it in terms of some higher goods, right? That they're going to be motivations, some of which are better than others on moral and ethical grounds, right? That one way or another we want to say that charity is better than greed, right? We want to set up some hierarchy of valuing courage over theft, or you know, you just make them all up for yourself. But the idea is that there was some great notion of what good, often capitalized G, good meant. It might have something to do with what was most divine in human nature and what was most base, and trying to support the divine or most human compared to what was most animal or most base in us, right? It was this kind of morality was a process of separating the good and the bad, and somebody was explaining to us which was which, right? We needed God to do it, right? Because left to our own devices, we were making a mess of things.
Where does Christ come into this?
Well, Christ is a revelation of pure goodness. And,
right.
He is saying things like, charity and meekness are better than things like happiness and wealth and success. He's creating a radically non-commonsensical hierarchy of values. Right? It's
ethics.
Huh?
They're ethics. I mean,
it's ethics, right? But it's. But it's not one based on pleasure and pain. It's not one based on eudaimonia. It's not one based on your individual personal flourishing. It's based on salvation, based on your following commandments, and on, in many ways, subjugating your desire for pleasure, not giving rein to it.
To me, too, it sounds kind of like, with a scientific overlay, what how Robert McNamara used to defend how they conducted the war in Vietnam. A very kind of over-intellectualized, best and brightest approach.
Well, yes. Every one of these guys sort of here sort of sees themselves as the best and the brightest.
Right.
And is going to tell you how we should run things.
The end of 15 is pretty good.
Where is that? You want to read something?
Yeah, unlike some other thinkers of the 18th century, Helvetii did not have too high an opinion of human nature. in the sense of thinking man naturally benevolent. He thinks him neither benevolent nor malevolent, but infinitely flexible and pliable, a kind of natural stuff which nature and circumstances, but above all education, shape as they will. He therefore thinks that it is of no use merely to try to improve mankind by argument. The purpose of reform is to establish new institutions designed to maximize pleasure and minimize pain, to make people as happy as possible and eliminate all the causes of misery, such as ignorance or injustice.
Right, right. And
sounds pretty good.
Yes, well, the
drawing with him.
The idea is that, as you said with Pavlov, is that we can set up institutions for conditioning. And Helvetii is a great believer in education. He wants to get a hold of children and organize them with a carrot and a stick in a way that will make them good, happy citizens, right? But it's a very top-down kind of process.
Right? This is interesting, too. This comes to the Christ business, where he says, all the preaching of all the Christian preachers in the past has done little good because men are what they are, because of their evil education, their sad circumstances, their poverty, yada, yada.
But
yeah, doesn't
their conditioning.
And so he says, how is a good new society to be organized? Certainly it cannot be a democracy, for people are often stupid and often vicious. And we know if we're guided by public opinion, we'll seldom get anything done, because men have dwelt in darkness too long to know what to do when they finally find themselves in the light of day.
Right? What page is that on?
This is on 20.
Oh.
Yes, it would seem to require somebody on top telling you what your pleasure should be.
Yes.
Well, someone educating you.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so educating you with a club if need be. You know?
Yes.
So this is Berlin's great criticism here, that he's saying what we have here is a guy who wants to get rid of the old oppressive hierarchies of church and state and replace them with something that he's claiming is both scientific and geared towards your happiness. The only problem is that he wants to be in charge of it. And
it's like the Sacklers give us the opioid crisis and the Temple of Denver. They're attempting to educate us. It's very strangeness.
Let me read one other thing, because it's we're going to get near the end, and I want to read this. One thing is clear. The kind of universe which Helvetius depicts, there is little or no room for individual liberty. In his world, men may become happy, but the notion of liberty eventually disappears. It disappears because liberty to do evil disappears, since everyone has now been conditioned to only do what is good. We have become like animals trained to seek only what is useful for us. Right? This becomes a brave new world. Right? Here are some of the other assumptions that get overridden by this picture. One is that specialists should be given supreme power because they understand how to run things. But the second, all ultimate aims are compatible with another. They cannot clash. But this proposition has often been refuted by human experience. For instance, liberty, which is the ultimate purpose of some, is at times been found to be incompatible with equality, which is the ultimate goal for others. It's difficult to see why honor should always and automatically be compatible with patriotism. The great tragedies, those written by the Greek dramatists, are largely concerned with the fatal collision of values which cannot be reconciled. precisely this was denied in the 18th century, because the most widespread belief of that age looked on nature as harmonious. And to say that nature was a harmony must mean to say that nothing real or valuable in it can conflict with anything else with it, what is real or valuable. In fact, this belief rests on a false analogy from logic and geometry. Just as in logic and in geometry, no true proposition can be incompatible with any other true proposition, so no value in the moral universe, if the moral universe is in harmony, of which there is a science, can conflict with any other value, right? And Concordant can say with great firmness, nature binds by an unbreakable chain truth, happiness, and virtue, right? This idea that nature is harmonious and harmony means values cannot clash, again, is something deeply ingrained in Buddhism, right? As Buddhists, we live in this harmonious world in which the real ultimate answers can't clash with each other, right? It's really all supposed to fit together. Berlin is really talking about a different kind of world, a world that has room for tragedy and irreconcilable conflicts and values that are equally true but incompatible. One of his favorite expressions is that liberty for the wolves is death to the lambs, right? That there is always going to be a conflict between values and natures, the nature of lambs and wolves, right? And that the fantasy of harmony quickly becomes a program of tyranny, right? And I think that he would find something of that in a monastery, right? As whatever virtues are being cultivated in a monastery, liberty is not high on the list, right? And that may be perfectly reasonable in a training setting for a certain amount of time. But if you think that the monastery is a model for the ideal society, and when Zen teachers came to America and established monasteries, they also established communities, and thought that the enlightened teacher who set up the monastery was also capable of organizing the Zen community on enlightened grounds, because who better to know how people should live their lives than a Zen master? Pluralism got lost, and certainly liberty was not high on the list of virtues being cultivated. So I think we have to end that with that now. I think the point of this is not to see how different somebody like Helvetii is from us, but how much alike. Okay? All right. Thank you all.